Case number 06-1045 et al. Natural Resources Defense Council Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Number 1, Knox SIP call RACT issue, NRDC issue 2. Mr. Barron for the petitioner, Mr. Link for the respondent. Number 2, state implementation plan issues, RACT in subpart 1, areas 15% of progress plans and clean data policy, NRDC issues 1, 4, and 5. Mr. Barron for the petitioner, Mr. Link for the respondent. And number 3, new source review issues, NRDC issues 6 and 7, New Jersey issue 3. Mr. Barron for the petitioner and Mr. Link for the respondent.
May it please the court, David Barron for Petitioner Natural Resources Defense Council. The Clean Air Act requires the use of reasonably available pollution control technology at factories and power plants in communities with unsafe levels of ozone or smog. We're here challenging EPA's waiver of that RACT requirement for plants that are participating in the NOx SIP call, which is an interstate trading program that lets a plant avoid installing any pollution controls at all and even increase its emissions just by purchasing emission credits from another plant that can be 1,000 miles away. That waiver violates Section 172 of the Clean Air Act, which requires RACT emission cuts, quote, from existing sources in the area, close quote, meaning in the non-attainment area, the specific city or county designated by EPA as violating standards.
Was your brief, did you object to the EPA's actions in part on the ground of the distance between the areas?
Well, the objection is that the reductions come from outside the area. The distance,
whether it's 1,000 miles away or the adjacent area, wasn't your point.
It's not. It's not legally material, but it is. It is material to show the sort of extremeness of this.
For clarity, it would be helpful, at least to me, if we didn't have any more talk of waivers. There's no waiver provisions in the statute. No waivers being exercised. The agency's interpreted the statute and promulgated a rule that makes certain provisions inapplicable to certain circumstances, and that's your objection.
Well, in our view, that is a waiver, Your Honor, but...
Well, they don't have to, they're not granting anyone waivers. Is there a case-by-case waiver procedure here?
Well, no, but they're waiving the requirement for everyone, basically, who participates in this program.
Think of it that way. I think it's not conducive to clarity. Go on.
Well, determination of inapplicability also violates Section 182B2 of the statute, which requires implementation of RACT with respect to all, quote, all major sources that are located in the area, referring to any area that is moderate or above ozone classification. So, for example, Section 182B2 requires that all major sources in the Chicago area, which is a moderate ozone non-attainment area, install RACT controls. But EPA's rule lets all of those sources, or any of those sources, avoid any RACT controls at all just by purchasing emission allowances from a plant, say, in Virginia or Massachusetts. No provision of the Act allows EPA to dispense with RACT controls in this manner. The statute relied on by EPA for the NOx-CIP call, Section 110A2D of the Act, requires states to prevent their emissions from significantly contributing to non-attainment in other states. Nowhere does it dispense with the separate and distinct requirements for RACT controls inside each area.
Well, EPA now says the, quote, as may be obtained, close quote, is an ambiguous phrase.
Yes, Your Honor. They rely on that language in Section 172, but that doesn't dispense with the previous language in the sentence that says the emission reductions must come from existing sources in the area. So even if you read that language as saying you have to achieve something equivalent in the way of reductions, those reductions have to come from those sources in the area. Moreover, a Section 182b2, which is the other provision we're relying on, doesn't have that language. It requires implementation of RACT with respect to all sources that are located in the area. Now, EPA claims that the SIP call will achieve greater collective emission reductions than RACT. But even if that was true, and we don't concede that it is true, that doesn't dispense with these statutory mandates that I mentioned. Moreover, nowhere did EPA find that the SIP call would in fact produce greater emission reductions inside each non-attainment area. They only estimated that collectively the 22 states combined, if they all participated in the SIP call, would achieve a greater collective reduction than would RACT, not greater reductions inside individual areas. And in fact, the SIP call allows the very opposite result. It allows these sources to choose not, in a non-attainment area, to choose not to control, and therefore does not require greater reductions. It allows less in the way of reductions. I'd like to reserve, unless there are other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time on this issue.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Link. I'm from the Department of Justice. On behalf of EPA, I will present argument on each of the three categories of issues today. With me at council table are Sarah Schneeberg and Diane McConkey. I'd like to actually start with making two points that distinguish this case from the recent decision in North Carolina, which found that a trading program under the CARE statute was not a valid means of implementing Section 110A2D's requirement to eliminate emissions that contribute significantly to non-attainment in other areas. And the two distinctions I just wanted to note were that unlike the provisions we're talking about here, the RACT provisions, Section 110A2D does not use the terms reasonably available in describing what provisions states must adopt in their SIPs. That phrase, of course, is one that this court previously in the 2002 Sierra Club decision noted inherently implies some discretion by EPA in deciding what controls are necessary. Second, in the North Carolina decision, the court noted that CARE had been designed as a complete remedy to prevent significant contribution. And therefore, in that case, if there was any doubt that the method EPA had employed was going to ensure the elimination of emissions that would significantly contribute, it was not a valid approach. Also, because it did not give any weight to the interference with maintenance requirement of that statutory provision, the fact that it was a complete remedy, again, was a problem. Here, EPA has made clear that while it has found that the reductions required under the NOx-CIP call constitute RACT for NOx emissions, that areas still must achieve those reductions that are necessary to demonstrate RFP and to timely attain, and to attain as expeditiously as practicable, which means that they may have to go beyond the reductions called for under this budget trading program if it's determined necessary for those reasons. And again, the factual findings in this rulemaking make EPA's approach.
They wouldn't have to do RAC, isn't that correct?
They would have to implement such measures. Well, the EPA noted that there are two things that might be necessary. The states have discretion to require beyond RAC controls, and they must implement such measures as will ensure RFP and attainment.
Promulgating a rule?
Well, in many circumstances, ordinarily, a RAC analysis would be done at the state level, looking source by source. In this case, EPA had data that it had developed during the NOx-CIPCOL promulgation, which indicated that there were going to be greater reductions achieved from the adoption of the controls under this program, and that the cost of buying allowances was sufficiently high that many, though not all, sources were likely to install controls and not simply trade.
What about the disconnect with the area? Does the data, if we were to look at the data, could we find that those conclusions exist as to the individual areas as well?
Well,
as to the sources in the individual areas?
Well, I think there's two levels there. I mean, certainly there, to begin with, is the question of whether this statute plainly necessitates that each individual source in an area install controls. We believe that the statute is ambiguous on that issue, and many of the petitioners do not appear to dispute that. In any event, that is an interpretation that is supported by the language used in the RAC provisions, and certainly the policy of averaging emissions is a longstanding one. In terms of whether it must track each area specifically, I think the question is whether, if the record supports a conclusion that reductions on the whole are going to be greater than RACT, and that in general a significant number of sources will install controls in the various areas, whether that supports this as a reasonable construction of the provisions.
How can it?
Sorry.
In other words, if all the success was in one region and this disaster in another region overall may be better, but not in those particular areas where there is a disaster.
I mean, that is a theoretical, in theory, that is a concern. As a practical matter, as EPA noted in responding to comments, there are other checks on the extent to which emissions in a particular area can exceed a certain threshold, because those areas must attain.
That's what I'm just trying to understand.
That's true, but in saying RACT, it also says reasonably available. And, you know, again, the question is, if the record indicates that the controls that will be installed as a consequence of complying with this program are going to achieve greater reductions on the whole, whether some more stringent level of control is reasonably available is an issue that EPA had discretion to consider.
What do you say about the bearing of the North Carolina case on this issue?
Repeat your question, please.
What is the bearing of the North Carolina case on this issue?
The variant? Well, again, I think that there are two key differences in North Carolina. I think one is the statutory language EPA was implementing there, which does not use the terms reasonably available, and requires that the SIP provisions adopted to comply with 110A2D prohibit the emission of any air pollutant in amounts that will contribute significantly to non-attainment. So that is a distinctly different language. And again, the court noted in that opinion that because CARE was presented by EPA as the definitive means of complying with that requirement, if the use of the cap and trade approach created doubt as to whether each state was going to eliminate emissions that would contribute significantly, then it couldn't be considered a valid approach. Unless you have any further questions, I'll prepare for the next set of issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, we obviously are not relying on the North Carolina decision, which came out after we briefed this case. We're relying on the plain language of the statutory provisions that we mentioned. And those provisions require whatever emission reductions you attribute to RACT to come from sources in the area. And whether that allows for some sort of an emissions averaging program inside the area, the court need not decide here, because the only issue is whether EPA can let sources avoid installing control technology, which is what this statute requires, by purchasing allowances from a source somewhere else outside of the non-attainment area. And our argument is a plain statutory language argument. The statute doesn't allow that. Council indicated the states are free to require controls beyond what the SIP call requires, but that doesn't satisfy the statute. The statute requires RACT level control in the area and doesn't make it something optional for states to do if they so choose. And the reasons for this, are not really material here in terms of the statutory language, but Congress obviously set certain minimum pollution control requirements because it wanted an assured level of pollution reduction, regardless of the vagaries of predictions about how much would be needed to attain. As to the prediction that many sources are likely to install controls, in response to the SIP call, the fact of the matter is that EPA didn't do any analysis at all with respect to the NOx SIP call on which sources in which areas would or would not install pollution controls. And the record shows that there are sources that have not controlled at all under the SIP call, instead have bought allowances. That's the way it's supposed to work. And as an interstate trading scheme, that may be fine. But for purposes of the requirements for controls inside each area, it doesn't satisfy the statute. Unless there are further questions, I'll close on this issue.
That's fine.
Shall I move on to the next set of issues? This part of the case, we're challenging EPA's determination not to require RACT controls in subpart 1 ozone non-attainment areas that claim they can meet the standard on time without such controls. That waiver or determination of inapplicability violates the mandate in section 172C1 for adoption of RACT controls, quote, at a minimum, close quote, in each non-attainment area. Now, EPA justifies this waiver on the grounds that it reads the more general requirement of the Act for reasonably available control measures as only requiring such measures as are needed to attain on time. But unlike that general requirement, Congress explicitly required non-attainment areas to adopt RACT at a minimum, which in plain English means at least. EPA's rule reads at a minimum out of the statute, contrary to settled rules of construction, and that's our basis for challenging this approach.
I wasn't confident that was the way to read the statute, because it seemed to me that it was such reductions at a minimum that were required.
That's right. Such reductions from existing sources in the area as may be obtained through the adoption at a minimum of RACT. Now, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question, the issue here is not whether whether EPA might use some other equivalent measures to obtain the same reductions that they would achieve through RACT at a minimum. We're not arguing about that here, but what we are arguing is that EPA has to require such emission reductions as may be obtained through RACT at a minimum, and EPA is not requiring that here. They're not requiring RACT, and they're not requiring some equivalent level of reductions to what you would get from RACT.
I'm looking for the phrase. Where in the statute is it?
This is in 172,
right?
C1. It's on
C1.
SA23 of our appendix.
All right. Such plan provisions shall provide for the implementation of all reasonably available control measures, including such reduction as expeditiously as practical, including such reductions in emissions as may be obtained through the adoption at a minimum of RACT. Now that strikes me as saying that that what's required is RACM, at least to the extent that it would produce RACT, or that RACT would produce reductions, at least to that extent.
Well, at least RACM, at least RACT, or the reductions that RACT would produce.
Well, there's a difference.
Right.
Right. There's an important difference, isn't there?
Well, it's not really material here because EPA isn't requiring either.
You're saying they're reading out. What are you saying they're reading out of the statute?
They're essentially reading out the whole parenthetical.
It seemed to me that the way you're reading it is reading out the phrase in the parenthetical, such reductions in emissions from existing sources in the area as may be obtained through the adoption at a minimum of. And you're reading it to say, provide for the implementation of all reasonably available control measures as expeditiously as practicable, including reasonably available control technology.
No, we're saying including at a minimum.
Including at a minimum, then
reasonably available control technology,
so
or
reductions in emissions. That's right.
Yes, and
it seems to be a material in your reading of the statute.
I'm sorry, which
you seem to be reading that part of it out.
Which
reductions in emissions, etc.
No, Your Honor, we're not reading that out because what we're challenging here is EPA is requiring neither RACT in these areas nor the minimum reductions you would achieve from RACT. They're taking that off the table.
Would be responsive to what I'm saying. Let's read it that way. You're saying they're not requiring the minimum reductions that would be required by RACT.
They're not requiring that either, Your Honor. And that's so we don't really need to get into the question of whether they could require something equivalent or whether RAC controls are required at each source.
It may be material to whether your argument is persuasive as to whether we're talking about which interpretation of the statute.
Well, the problem with EPA's approach, Your Honor, is it reads at a minimum out of the statute. There's really, if you're taking the approach they're taking, at a minimum doesn't need to be in there at all. RACT is just one of any reasonably available control measures that are required only if they're going to advance the attainment date
on the reading that I'm giving it, at a minimum does play a role, right?
It does, but they're not reading it that way either. And mm-hmm. I mean, you can ask them that, but they're not requiring the equivalent to RACT either in these areas. Now, EPA's rule also illegally dispenses with the Clean Air Act's mandate.
Excuse me, is this the section as to which the agency is invoking the Tenth Circuit case?
That's the next.
Okay.
The next argument I was just about to get to. this the so-called clean data policy.
That's right.
Where EPA is dispensing with mandates for percentage rate of progress cuts or plans and contingency plans in areas that are temporarily meeting standards. The Act's requirements for these measures contain no provisions at all waiving them in areas that are temporarily attaining. Congress did provide a specific path for areas to avoid adopting additional plans and measures if they're meeting standards, namely formal redesignation to attainment under Section 107 of the statute. But to qualify for such redesignation, the statute requires the area to show not only that it's currently meeting standards, but that its compliance is due to permanent and enforceable reductions, and that it has a plan in place to assure that the area will stay in compliance for at least 10 years and another plan 10 years after that.
Could I ask a question? I don't know if I can make myself clear, but an area is in non-attainment. This is my hypothetical. And then for 3 years it has clean data. Then it makes an application for redesignation. And EPA takes it under advisement, and then let's hypothetically say 3 months later, approves the redesignation. Why isn't 175AC, which is the provision you're relying on here?
Well, it is, Your Honor. I was just about to get to that. 175 capital A, I'm sorry.
175 capital A little c at SA 28.
Yes, that's.
That's what you're relying on. Here,
yes.
This argument, isn't
yes.
It? And why can't EPA reasonably read that to mean it only applies for that period during which EPA is taking into account whether or not to redesignate the area? In other words,
what?
That limited window. An area is in non-attainment. It does things such that for 3 years it has data showing that it has met the standards. So it applies to EPA for a redesignation. Now, from that point until the point at which EPA decides to redesignate the area, C is saying until such plan revision is approved, and an area is redesignated as attainment, for any area designated as a non-attainment area, the requirements of this part shall continue in force and effect, so that if during that period of 3 years, I'm saying, where they have clean data, there's no need for certain requirements, 175C wouldn't go as far as you're arguing, would it?
Well, I think it does, Your Honor. It says until the plan revision referring to the maintenance plan is actually approved, the requirements pertaining to non-attainment areas remain in full effect. So it doesn't suspend them while an application for plan approval is pending.
So is the statutory scheme such that you're designated non-attainment and you have all of these obligations under the statute, and until you are officially redesignated by EPA, there's no lapse in the application of any of those requirements? In other words, the clean air policy doesn't give you a pass. It's the two EPA actions that have to occur.
That's our position, Your Honor. And I should say that this clean data policy is not limited to the hypothetical you described. States can get these clean data waivers even if they have never applied for redesignation for attainment and have no intention of applying. I think unless there are further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank
I'd like to address the subpart one issue, RACT issue first, and then the 15% RFP before I get to the clean data policy, if that's okay with your honors. On the issue of subpart one RACT, let me first read the rule language. So just to be clear, the rule does require RACT in these areas, and what we're talking about are areas under subpart one that we're projecting attainment in 5 years or less after designation for the 8-hour NAC, so by 2009. And what it says is that for those areas, the state shall meet the RACT requirement by submitting an attainment demonstration SIP demonstrating that the area has adopted all control measures necessary to demonstrate attainment as expeditiously as practicable. So there's no dispute here about whether the rule should, and it in fact does require RACT. The question is, was it permissible to interpret Section 172 to allow an interpretation that RACT is required to the extent it expedites the attainment date, to the extent it assists in the area's attainment as expeditiously as practicable. Now, if I can backtrack a bit to the 1977 statute before the 1990 amendments, at that point in Section 172, you had two separate provisions. You had a RACM provision, similar to the current one, and you had a separate RACT provision. And as we explained in our briefs, both of those provisions at that time were interpreted by EPA to allow compliance to the extent that, in the case of RACM, additional measures would expedite the attainment date, and in the case of RACT, to allow compliance by adopting additional controls to the extent it would expedite the attainment date. And to quote specifically, if RACT controls must be implemented at that time by enough additional sources covered by each control techniques guideline to provide for reasonable further progress and attainment as expeditiously as practicable. That's quoting from 44 Fed Reg 20,376, column 3. So that was how EPA interpreted those provisions then. In 1990, Congress amends the statute, and what does it do? It takes the separate RACT provision and puts it into a parenthetical inside the RACM provision. So to the extent there's any question about whether whether Congress had, in amending the statute in 1990, intended to countermand the way EPA previously interpreted the statute, the evidence suggests otherwise. It changed the statute in a way that made EPA's reading even more plausible. Now, the second point is that the RACM sentence in Section 172, as it now is written, has been interpreted by EPA to allow, again, an interpretation that it requires measures that are reasonably available for implementation in the area and would advance the area's attainment date. That's
as expeditiously
as possible. So if the measures are necessary to timely attain and or to attain as expeditiously as possible, they are required. But if they are not necessary to meet those goals, they are not required. That interpretation was reviewed by this court in the 2002 Sierra Club decision, and the court decided that it agreed that reasonably available in the context of this paragraph was again a phrase that permitted EPA discretion, and that the provision was ambiguous as to whether any measures that won't result in more expeditious attainment are required. And so it deferred to EPA's interpretation that they were not. Now, the RACT provision is in a parenthetical that starts with the word including. And so the problem here with the competing interpretation that NRDC suggests is that they overlook the word including. I mean, they're essentially, in the reply brief, suggesting that you have a RACM requirement as interpreted by EPA and as upheld by this court, and then you have a distinct RACT requirement in which RACT must be adopted irrespective of whether additional controls would make attainment more expeditiously. Those two interpretations are not harmonious. Clearly, one is contrary to the other. And since the statute says on its face that RACM includes RACT, then it does not make sense to read the statute in the way that NRDC is suggesting. They argue that, as you've heard, that EPA's interpretation is flawed because it doesn't give full effect to the words at a minimum. But I think that issue was addressed by the Supreme Court in the Chickasaw Nation case, where the court noted that While it is often said every clause and word of the statute should, if possible, be given effect, that canon of statutory construction, like all the canons, is a guide, not an absolute rule, and it's not always conclusive in construing a statute. And it's not conclusive here because it leads to the problem I just explained in reading the text on the whole. Turning to, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I thought I had your argument until you went into that case.
Okay.
That case you read for the proposition that sometimes you just can't make use of every word. So correct. What words are you not making use of?
In my view, the only words that aren't given full effect here are the words at a minimum to the extent that they are taken literally to mean that additional controls must be adopted irrespective of whether they would result in more expeditious attainment or timely attainment. But certainly RACT is required if it's necessary to timely attain and or if it will make attainment happen more expeditiously. And that is clear from the text of the rule that I read at the start of my remarks.
Did you follow the alternative that I was discussing with Mr. Barron?
I did, but I think that ultimately it seems to me the dispute on this particular provision of EPA's rule is not as much about the word reductions and more about the words reasonably available on the one hand and the way that's been interpreted by this and upheld by this court and the words at a minimum. And then, of course, the word including. They say we don't give full effect to the word at a minimum. We think that they're alternative would not give full effect to the word including.
And
we think that
my reading gives every word some effect. I don't need Chickasaw Mountain or whatever.
If we went under your reading, then yes. but I think that, again, you know, the word including also, when you look back at the history of this statute and how the separate RAC provision was moved from a separate provision into the parenthetical, I think also helps to support, frankly, a common sense reading of the word including here, that RACT in this paragraph, in this provision, is a subset of RACM. And if RACM is reasonably read to be limited to measures that will advance the attainment date, result in more expeditious attainment, and or are necessary to meet the attainment date, then it is quite reasonable to conclude that the same is true with respect to the included subset of RACT controls. With regard to 15% RFP, the arguments are made in the briefs that this rule, EPA's rule, by allowing areas that have implemented a 15% VOC reduction under the one-hour standard to move on to other RFP requirements is somehow allowing them to take credit for reductions in the 90s. That's not what the rule does. Every area under EPA's rule is required to implement RFP in the years after following the baseline, in the 2000s. And the only question is, which provision must they implement? There is, of course, 181B1A, which is the provision requiring the initial 15% VOC reduction. There is also 182C, which contains a requirement for more stringent reductions. 182C? 182C2B. Yes, 182C2B. And what that does is, under the statute as written, starting in 1990, moderate and above areas all had 6 years to implement the 15% VOC reduction. And then moderate areas were supposed to attain within 6 years. So there was no provision made for what happened next.
Could I just be clear? 182C2B, that's the one that says the baseline is 1990?
No, B182, I'm sorry. Take a quick look.
I was in B.
No problem. 182B1B is the provision that defines baseline emissions.
Right.
Where are
as
you
emissions
this?
In 1990?
Wasn't it to C2B?
C2B is
okay.
The
reasonable further progress demonstration.
Right. If you want to refer to it as the second phase of RFP for any area that's serious or above non-attainment. And then there is a provision that resets the baseline under certain circumstances, specifically 181B1 in the last half of the last sentence in that provision says that the baseline is automatically reset from 1990 when an area that is designated attainment is subsequently redesignated to non-attainment. But what the provision doesn't speak to is what happens if an area is non-attainment under the NAAQS, implements the initial 15% reduction, then the NAAQS is revised, and then it's designated non-attainment again under the new revised NAAQS. It doesn't address that question. And so because the statute was silent, EPA had to fill the gap.
Okay. You heard my questions. And as I understand the petitioners, they're saying basically the statute is written, so you're obligated until you have these official actions by EPA. And you're saying that, well, the statute addresses this 15% in some circumstances, but not in others as to setting the baseline.
Correct. And I think now your comment about the statute as written, I mean, I think that I'm not sure if you were referring to the issue under the clean data policy. This is a different issue than the clean data policy.
Right.
Because there's no question here under this portion of the rule that areas must implement RFP, and this doesn't involve any assessment of whether because an area has a certain quality of clean air that it need not implement it. The only question is which provision must it implement? And so basically, because there was the gap I mentioned in the statute, EPA said, well, we think we construe this statute to require that if you have already implemented the 15% VOC reduction before the NAAQS revision and you remain in non-attainment and you are a serious area, you have to move up to the next more stringent set of reductions, 3% per year, but they can be VOC or NOx or a combination. If you are a moderate area and you've implemented that 15% VOC reduction, then you move on and you...
The statute says 1990 is the baseline.
Right.
And then it says if you are designated an attainment area and you fall back into non-attainment, then we reset the baseline.
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying that if you've done the 15% once and you're non-attainment, that's all you have to do.
Not quite. Saying two things. First, if the statute had also expressly addressed the question of whether the baseline resets in this circumstance, where you're non-attainment under the NAAQS and then non-attainment again, then it would directly apply and there wouldn't be any room for interpretation. But it is silent, and we're saying that if you've implemented the 15% under the 1 hour NAAQS, that's not all you have to do. You still have to implement RFP, but you have the flexibility to do it under Section 172, under Subpart 1, in other words.
I just want to understand how EPA is reading this statute. In other words, if the statutory scheme is such that when you're in non-attainment, you're looking at the 1990 baseline, and you have to apply the 15% provision.
Right.
And then the statute says, and this is an interpretation, that's what I want to understand.
Right.
It says, now the only time that the baseline changes is if you've been in attainment and you slip back to non-attainment. So looking at the statutory scheme where we're trying to get to these areas up to attainment, why do you read in an exception, what I'm trying to understand?
Well, because since it doesn't provide for baseline resetting in any other circumstance, I mean, one way to have read it would be to say that the baseline is still 1990 for every area but those that were attainment and then non-attainment. But it doesn't explicitly say that either, and EPA found that to be not a reasonable reading of the statute for reasons it discussed in response to comments, that among other things, it would involve crediting areas for reductions 15 years prior to the NAAQS revision. And also there was a big difference in the inventories in the 1990s versus now, because of course there are different non-attainment areas than there were at that time, to the extent that additional areas have become in non-attainment, et cetera. And there were practical problems with that approach as well. Now, the other point is, I mean, it may be helpful to keep in mind, most of the areas we're talking about that are subject to this portion of the rule, to the extent that they need more than 5 years to attain, they're still implementing 15%. They're required to do that. It's just that they are permitted to do it with VOC reductions and or NOx or a combination. And if they are projecting attainment in 5 years or less, they still have to implement reductions as will achieve attainment as expeditiously as practicable, which may be less than 15% in that five-year period. But if they need more than 5 years to attain, then they have to do 15% over 6 years, just like they would have done when they implemented B1A. Again, the only difference being that it can be a combination of NOx or VOCs, or it can be NOx instead of VOCs. If I may briefly address the clean data policy as I'm over time, I just want to point out that the NRDC has conceded in its reply that it has not challenged in this case EPA's interpretation that an area does not have to submit an attainment demonstration if its air quality is already attaining the NAAQS and is so determined.
Can I interrupt and go back, because I need to just be very clear about this. As I understood your point, it's that if an area needs less than 5 years to attain,
yes,
it may not have to do the 15% reduction.
That's right.
It may need to do, 12%, 10%?
It could vary depending on the circumstance of that area.
But it will have to do something other than simply the 3%.
It will have.
In other words, I thought part of the problem here was the argument that was being made that EPA is saying, well, once you've done the 15%, you're home free. After that, all you need to do is the 3%. And what I heard you say, and maybe I misunderstood, was that if you're not going to attain in 5 years, you may still need to do some portion of the 15%, even if you've previously done the 15%.
I should make sure we have the right, when we talk about 3%, by the way, we're talking about 3% per year,
right,
which means roughly over 6 years, it's 18%. So it might sound as if 3% is less than, right. But my point is simply that the 3% per year requirement for serious areas is actually a greater level of reduction than the initial 15, because over.
Built on the 15%.
It is.
How many times do you have to do the
15? It is. Well, you get 6 years to do 15. So let's just say this is not precise math, but that's 2.5% per year. And then if you're a serious area, you start implementing 3% per year reduction. So they are actually greater reductions. But what happens is that you are permitted by the statute to reduce either NOx or VOC or a combination, whereas the initial 15% has to be VOCs. Under NRDC's alternative reading, instead of serious areas having to start implementing a greater reduction per year, 3% versus 2.5, they go back and can do 2.5 again, although they were limited to VOCs as a consequence of the NOx revision. Just briefly finishing that point about clean data policy, if I may, NRDC did not challenge the interpretation that areas need not submit an attainment demonstration SIP if the air quality is already attaining the NAAQS. And we would suggest that for the reasons explained in our briefs, it is equally reasonable to conclude that the statute does not require you to show how you will make reasonable further progress towards attaining if, again, your air quality is already attaining the NAAQS. And the further point I'd like to make is that to the extent they suggested the Tenth Circuit decision we rely on is contrary to case law in this court, those cases are both distinct. In Sierra Club, the court rejected the proposition that an area not in attainment, with air quality not meeting the NAAQS, could avoid submitting an RFP SIP because it was expected that future upwind reductions would bring it into attainment. That's not what EPA is doing here. It's not relying on hypothetical future reductions. What it's saying is we looked at 3 years of clean air of data and we see that the area is in attainment now. The other case they cite is South Coast, and the portion of the opinion they cite in their reply brief is referring to the question of whether Part 1 measures previously adopted by a state could be dropped once the area reached attainment. And again, This policy is not allowing any area to drop measures it's already adopted into its SIP. The only thing it affects is, do they have to submit a new SIP? Unless you have further questions, I'll go back for the last set of issues.
Thank you.
On the on the RACT issue, I don't think it's correct for the government to argue that it's not possible to give effect to the at a minimum language in that RACT provision. It's possible and it's plausible. For policy reasons, they don't want to, but it's not like there's an irreconcilable conflict between requiring reasonably available control measures as are necessary to attain, which have to include at the very minimum RACT or the emission reductions as may be obtained from RACT. The EPA said it's long read RACT as only what's needed to attain, but those statements were in non-binding guidance documents and they can't override a clear congressional language. Turning to the questions about the 15%, but just to clarify things here, the original 1990 Act required rate of progress percentage annual reductions from baseline emissions, which at that time was 1990 for the old 1 hour standard. 8 hour standard was adopted 1997. EPA didn't even designate areas for the 8 hour standard until 2004. So EPA decided that for the purpose of those rate of progress requirements that originally applied to the old 1 hour standard, it had to come up with a new baseline, which it did. 2002, it's actually not quite 2004, but that was the most recent year they had data for these inventories. So the new baseline, according to EPA, and we don't challenge that here, is now 2002. For all of these rate of progress requirements, and they don't dispute that. And if 2002 is the baseline, the statute requires a 15% cut from that baseline, a requirement that isn't satisfied by a 15% cut that occurred in 1990 to 1996 from a 1990 baseline. Now, EPA said that we're not challenging the clean data waiver for attainment demonstrations. I mean, the short answer to that is we're not obligated to challenge everything they do that's wrong, but, you know, it has the same problems. We're just not asking the court to address it here. The policies we've identified are mandated by the statute, and EPA can't waive them based on temporary attainment.
In the reference you made a moment ago to the baseline, were you addressing 182C2B?
Well, yes, it uses the same baseline as 182B1.
That's where you really are.
Yeah, the baseline emissions, excuse me, are the same in both 182B1, capital B, and I believe somewhere in 182B2, it applies the same baseline. So our argument is since they reset the baseline to 2002, which we're not disputing, no one's disputing, the progress has to be from that baseline.
And are you saying that with respect to an area that has already gone through the first round, the 15% from the 1990 baseline?
That's right, Your Honor. Because that's as Mr.
I'm having a little trouble making it. I'm not confident I'm grasping the argument.
Right.
Statute, to be loose about it, says 1990 is the baseline, cut 15% from 1990 over the ensuing 6 years, right? They do that.
Yes.
They some non-attainment area state does that. The agency comes back and says, we're setting a new baseline, if you will, and we're going to require further progress beyond that. What is it about the statute that suggests that it's not a one-time matter, that when they reset a baseline administratively, that it goes back and re-triggers an event that seemed to have been closed out by 96?
Well, it's the not just the statute, but the Supreme Court's decision in the Whitman case construing the statute. The Supreme Court told EPA that it had to come up with a way of adapting the new 8-hour standard to these requirements, to these very requirements in subpart 2 of Part D of the Act. And EPA has done that. And they have, their way of doing that was resetting the baseline from 1990 to 2002, and that restarts the clock here on all of these requirements.
Well, that restarts the clock here is the issue, right? In other words, if this is all history, and they then, in implementing the mandate of Whitman, say we're moving to an 8-hour max or the other, whichever it is, we're changing the standard. There's nothing obvious about changing the standard, unless there's something very specific in Whitman that you're pointing to. Nothing obvious about changing the standard that suggests that this provision isn't time frozen, let's say, that it starts over.
Well, Your Honor, what is suggesting it's not time frozen is that the requirement for percentage reductions is a requirement for reductions from baseline emissions and after the baseline. So if we're redefining the word baseline emissions for purposes of this statute, which EPA has done, to be 2002 emissions, then the cuts have to be from that baseline, not from a 1990 baseline. And those reductions that occurred 10 years ago, as Mr. Link indicated, don't count for that. EPA takes that position itself. So it's inconsistent.
Doesn't make it any more understandable.
Well, I mean, we agree their position is not understandable, but I guess the simplest way I can put it is you can't restart the clock on these rate of progress requirements and then take one kind of select set of areas and say, well, but you guys don't have to do this. The baseline is still 1990 for you. Or since you did this once under the 1-hour standard, you don't have to do it again, even though there's a brand new baseline here that everyone else is having to reduce from. Unless there are further questions on this, I will turn to the last set of issues, which concern new source review, or NSR, permits required by the Act in all non-attainment areas. Among other things, these permits have to require factories, proposed new factories, to obtain offsets, that is, obtain cuts in actual emissions, so that by the time the new source starts operating, there'll actually be a net decrease in emissions. EPA's rule violates this offset requirement by letting new sources claim offsets from the shutdown of factories that happened as long as 30 years ago. Those factories and their emissions obviously don't exist today, but EPA's rule lets the new source pretend that they do, and then claim that their new emissions will be offset by the old plant's shutdown. Under this approach, real-world emissions can actually be much higher after the new source starts operating than before. And that's completely contrary to the approach Congress set up in this statute, which says that the owner of the new plant can only meet the offset requirement by obtaining cuts in actual emissions, something that cannot be accomplished by relying on cuts obtained by somebody else 30 years ago by shutting down a plant. There aren't any...
What is it that puts this on the table? As you said, this has been the case for 30 years.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why is this now reopened? I'm at a loss to... They've been doing this for 30 years, and they've made a change. And the change is obviously new and fair game, but I'm not understanding what makes you think that the pre-existing program or interpretation is under scrutiny here.
Well, under this court's case law, the legality of a rule is reopened where the rule is changed, or the context of the rule is changed in such a way as to dramatically change the stakes. And here,
that interest is met if the change is subject to review.
And the change here is subject to review.
Okay. Not only that the change is subject to review, but that the pre-existing policy, which has been changed, is subject to review.
Well, this court has held that the very rule in which the change was made here includes this offset provision. Secondly, the change they made here was to expand the situations in which this offset provision could be used. So it can now be used in any area, basically, even one that doesn't have an approved attainment demonstration.
That's all fair game. That's new. Okay. But the underlying offset scheme has been around for a long time, as you said. And they haven't really altered that.
Well, this is part and parcel of that offset scheme. And in the Kennecott case, for example, this court held that a rule that the Department of the Interior didn't change at all in that rulemaking, didn't change a single word of that rule, was still subject to renewed challenge because the Department of Interior changed another rule that gave the first rule much greater significance. And that's what's going on here. Under the old rule, at least, an area, a source that wanted to claim offsets from one of these old shutdowns couldn't do that unless the area in which it was located had an approved attainment demonstration showing exactly how the area was going to meet standards. This new rule does away with that limitation. So now a brand new source can come into an area that already has unhealthy air violating standards. It can make the air quality worse without any plan in place for meeting the standard or showing how exactly they're going to offset the reductions from this new source. That's a huge change. It changes what was a very limited, an offset policy that had very limited availability to one that is virtually open-ended. And it makes it easier for these new sources to defeat the whole purpose of the offset program, which is to ensure that there's actual progress toward attainment.
Did they call for comment on the overall offset program?
They did not call for comments on the idea of whether they could ever use shutdowns for offsets, no, Your Honor. But our argument is that they constructively reopened that issue by making it a lot easier to get those offsets. Now, it's our position that allowing these offsets to be used flouts the whole statutory purpose. The statute requires the new source owner to obtain reductions in actual emissions. And there aren't any actual emissions from the shutdown source today. And unless the new source owner can engage in time travel, he or she can't go back 30 years and obtain emission reductions that happened because of something somebody else did.
So if there's a change in ownership, that's the key to your interpretation?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
No, that's why I don't know why you keep saying that. In other words, the question I had is, I understand the 30 years, going back to 1977, for example. What about 5 years back? What about 2 years back? What about a year back? I mean, where do you draw the line?
Well, the question is, are the emissions there for the new source owner to obtain reductions in them? If it's possible for the new source owner to obtain the reductions, then they're at least in the ballpark. Now, the statute also has a separate requirement, which is that allowable emissions after the new source starts operating have to be lower than emissions before it applied for a permit application. So, strictly speaking, those emission reductions have to occur after the permit application is filed. Otherwise, the statute isn't being met. And the whole idea here was to allow growth to occur in these areas that already had dirty air, that are violating standards, but to place a limit on that emissions growth so that it would be netted out. So if somebody wants to expand their factory or build a new one in a non-attainment area, they can do that. If they go out and find some other source in the area or some other emission point in the area that they can get actual reductions from, so the net result is the air is actually cleaner after the new source starts operating.
Everything you've said and everything you've complained about so far, you could have said and complained about 2 years ago or 10 years ago, right? Because that's all been true right along. That's not part of the new regime, in which now they've eliminated the requirement of an attainment demonstration. Isn't that right?
Well, Your Honor, it's possible we might have been able to raise some of these concerns before.
I don't know that you could legally raise them. I'm saying they're objections one might have articulated at any time in the past because this program was operating just the way you've described throughout the last 30 years.
It was not operating just the way I've described, because these offsets were only available in areas that had approved attainment demonstrations.
That's what's new.
Yes,
elimination of that requirement. Why don't you address it?
Well, we obviously think that violates the Act's anti-backsliding provisions, because sources that before had to obtain, that were located in areas lacking approved attainment demonstrations, which is most of the areas right now for the new standards, those sources under the old regime had to obtain brand new emission cuts to offset their new pollution. Now they don't have to do that at all. They can rely on these 30-year-old plus reductions that will mean, in effect, pollution will increase in these areas without any real offsets.
Other than being involved in the same rulemaking, what is it that ties the elimination, this change to the change in the NAAQS, such that the anti-backsliding rule applies?
Well, EPA itself adopted this change as part of its rule to
the same rulemaking,
to implement.
How does it relate to the change to the 8-hour standard in any relevant way?
Well, EPA adopted these rules to, in part, adapt its new source review program to the 8-hour standard, but it's our position that that's not essential for the anti-backsliding provision to be triggered. The statute requires that after a standard is revised, EPA shall adopt rules to ensure no less stringent requirements apply than before. And here, this rule was adopted after the standards were revised. Under this court's decision in the South Coast case, a new source review is covered by the Act's anti-backsliding provisions. And unless, if you were to read the statute as saying that as long as the agency says it's revising the rule in a way not connected to the standards revisions, it can weaken them, That would eviscerate.
It's not a question of what they say. I'm asking you, how is it in fact tied together? I mean, they can say it's not, and that's not the end of the matter if you can show that it is.
Well, we contend that it is. They adopted it as part of a comprehensive revision, but we also contend that that's not a necessary necessary feature of the action to trigger the anti-backsliding provisions.
So if it had been in a standalone rulemaking dealing strictly with the elimination of the approved attainment demonstration requirement, you would argue that that is in violation of the anti-backsliding?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, this just to give you an example, I see I'm over my time, but if it's permitted to give you an example, in the South Coast decision, EPA, the court held that EPA illegally relaxed restrictions on new source review that required higher offsets for areas that historically had violated the standard. EPA's rule allowed backsliding on that, and this was a rule to implement the new ozone standard. This court said that violated the anti-backsliding clause.
We deferred to EPA's interpretation that it did.
Of 172E. But if EPA had done the very same relaxation in a separate rulemaking, it wouldn't be any less of a violation of the anti-backsliding provision.
And equally, the fact that it's in the same rulemaking doesn't make it any more. Right? It's not a formal proposition. It's a functional one.
Well, we would argue that it's both factors here favor finding a violation of the anti-backsliding provision. Unless there are further questions, I see my time is way over.
I guess not. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, let me start with the reopener issue. It is an issue both for offsets and for the Appendix S challenge as well. And with regard to offsets, on the question of whether this is tied to the NAAQS revision, I think it's important to keep in mind that although the offsets rule change was finalized in 2005 as part of the same promulgation, it was proposed in 1996 before EPA had even revised the NAAQS, and a long time before EPA had proposed the rule to implement the revised NAAQS. So it is certainly clear that when EPA proposed, EPA proposed the change to the offsets totally absent any connection to a change in the NAAQS. It proposed that rule on its own. It did. I don't know why it took 9 years to finalize, but it did describe the two proposals as a consistent national program for NSR. That is what it said. But the fact is, it did propose it independently and before it had even revised the NAAQS. With regard to, and again, the council acknowledged that EPA on the offsets issue did not call for comments on the underlying question of whether they have any authority to use pre-baseline shutdowns as offsets. And I think that is conclusive on the question of how much is reopened here. There's no dispute that the change in the offsets rule is reopened, but EPA has allowed the use of banked reductions for later uses credits for 30 years. It's allowed
banked reductions for a limited class of sources. Now there's no limitation.
That's true, but again, part of the one challenge EPA NRDC is seeking to present here is whether EPA has any discretion to allow these credits for any sources, and we're saying that has not been reopened. In other words,
in Kennecott, the impact to industry was greater. Industry said, look, with the change that the agency has adopted, we're facing higher penalties.
But there was also, in Kennecott, in that case involved a regulation that defined the remedies available in a natural resource damages action under the Clean Water Act. And what happened is EPA had a regulation that defined these remedies, interpreted the statute. It didn't revise that reg, but it revised several others that were cross-referenced in it. And they created the implication that suddenly interim loss of interim services was now an available remedy, an implication that wasn't there before. And so this reopened the issue of, you know, what is the breadth of what statutory, what remedies are authorized by that statute.
But the impact on industry had changed as a result of the agency action.
But it's not just a question of impact on the agency. It's that indirectly, it's not just a question, though, of the practical impact. It is also that what EPA did, even though it didn't revise the rule directly, it still called into question how it was construing the statute because it made other changes that seemed to suggest it was adding to the list of.
But sort of Kennecott was the outer limits, and this isn't as far out as Kennecott. I mean,
I would agree with that because if the question.
If industry said, but you've done some other things that will potentially adversely affect us, and the court said it's sufficiently reopened that we're going to hear it. Now, the argument is the environmentalists are saying the impact has changed dramatically because it's not a regime that's limited to a narrow set of sources or a set of sources that have this attainment plan. It's just any source.
But the question then is, that there's no dispute that the court, if it agreed with the NRDC's argument that the change was not valid, could restore the status quo ante. But the status quo ante would be the 1989 reg. There's nothing that EPA did in this rulemaking
that
reexamined.
I didn't know that status quo ante.
Well, we
talked about that in Kennecott, didn't we?
We did cover that, though, in our brief. That
I know, in your brief.
In the 1989 reg, and as of that date and as of that promulgation, sources could use banked emission credits from prior to the baseline year, going back to and as far back as 1977. So then the question is, did the removal of the plan requirement, was that arbitrary or was that invalid? But the question isn't, can you allow sources to use?
Did you change the nature of the beast?
Either way, though, our argument is what they can't do is seek review now of whether the underlying premise that supported the 1989 rule was invalid or an improper construction of the statute. Emissions credits from a shutdown prior to the baseline inventory date. And again, all of the cases they cite in their brief are cases in which EPA either sought comment on whether its original statutory construction was valid or indirectly, as in Kennecott, reopened that issue. Here, it is clear that the agency did not ask, you know, are we correct in construing the statute to give us this authority? What it said was, we've already found we have that authority, we implemented it in a certain way, and we're not sure if we should implement it in a different way now to be true to our original intent. I mean, that was the issue with offsets, and that was the issue with the Appendix S waiver.
Right. I just want to be clear, though, the world was a different world when you had to have a plan, and then you could get through this narrow exception and use your bank credits. Now, the world is a very different place. You can use your bank credits regardless of whether you have a plan.
Well, and EPA found that, and again,
it's not
we don't dispute that issue is before you. And EPA explained that
on the world is different in the context of the Clean Air Act. The world has changed in that statutory context.
But by the same token, and this is more to the merits of whether the change is valid, as EPA explained in its rulemaking, the safeguards present in the statute now to prevent the worst-case scenarios from granting those credits are also different and more robust.
You named three in the rulemaking, didn't you?
Well, I think it referred to the more specific and more stringent RFP requirements, penalties for failing to meet RFP, penalties for timely non-attainment, the bump-up provisions. Much of that was added after EPA's prior rulemakings, and that made it more feasible to consider whether you still needed this approved plan requirement in place.
But the new requirements are all after the fact.
Yes.
The plan requirement was before the fact.
Right. And so,
I mean, you're going after polluters to penalize them. Before, they couldn't even do this unless they had a plan.
Right. And so the rationale for removing this requirement is that it's not necessary now the way the statute is written as of 1990. And EPA explained why it believed that was the case. One other point, by the way, on whether there's an argument in the brief that the 1990 amendments themselves reopened the issue for review, but I think that proposition is answered by Environmental Defense versus EPA. They could have petitioned for rescission of the reg in light of the 1990 amendments if they believed that the reg was now inconsistent with the statute as amended. They did not do that.
Why isn't it a problem under the anti-backsliding?
Because it does not change the controls that must be in place. It doesn't change the offset ratios. Whatever that ratio is, as specified in the statute, it still has to be met in order to issue the permit. The only question is the date limitation on which shutdown sources can be credited against the new source. With regard to
wait a second, but why is that? That is a relaxation of one dimension here, right? Not requiring that there be an approved attainment demonstration is a relaxation of the pre-existing rule.
Well, it's a change in a precondition, but it is not changing what offsets, the quantity of offsets that are necessary in order to issue that permit. And again, we talked earlier about whether the offset change was part of and connected with the revision to the NAAQS. I pointed out it was proposed before the NAAQS was even revised. It seems as if NRDC is suggesting that it doesn't matter, any change at any time is still subject to 172E. But that is running pretty far from the plain language of the statute, which to begin with, of course, only refers to relaxation of an NAAQS. EPA has construed it to also apply to a revision that strengthened the NAAQS. Mm-hmm. But now to take it one step further and say it applies to some other provision adopted independently is pretty far from what the statute says. With regard to Section 6 of Appendix S, if I may briefly address that again, just to make clear for the record, Appendix S and Section 6, the section that they have, that NRDC is concerned with, have been part of EPA's regulation since 1979. And the regulation codifying it for the first time was 44 Federal Reg 3274, and specifically pages 3282 and 83 discuss Appendix S and Section 6, sorry. So we have the same problem there that we do with offsets, in that it's one thing to challenge the change that was made in Section 6 in this rulemaking. It's another thing to challenge Section 6 in and of itself. And although the agency during the rulemaking solicited comment on whether its approach was practical, it did not, and it made sense, et cetera, it did not in the preambles to its proposal give any indication that it was re-examining the question of whether it has authority to grant case-by-case waivers. And I would refer you to pages 269 to 271 of the joint appendix contain the preamble experts that are topical on this issue. There's a variety of requests for comment.
What?
269 to 271. You'll see a variety of requests for comment there, but none of them are requests for comment on the issue of underlying statutory authority. And the agency questioned whether it should narrow, instead of granting case-by-case waivers broadly, should narrow it to a limited subset of what it called transitional areas in order to be consistent with the circumstances as it believed them to be at the time it originally adopted this rule. So again, this wasn't a question of statutory authority. It was a question of whether should EPA change the reg to be consistent with its original intent, not a question of whether it was being inconsistent with Congress's intent.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
Mr. Barron, you want to take a minute or two? Let me ask you specifically on this last point, that is to say the Appendix S point. In your brief, you didn't say in so many words that you didn't argue in so many words that the elimination of the 18-month limitation was arbitrary and capricious. Is that correct? You argued only that it's a violation of the anti-backsliding rule?
Well, I think we argued both because the although I can't remember that we argued specifically that 18 months was okay, whereas I mean we argued that 18 month that it was anti-backsliding.
Yes, it clearly did.
Right.
That.
Yeah.
But I think that's all.
I think that's all. Yes, Your Honor. On that point. I think EPA's claim that it didn't reopen that issue is just not valid. They proposed to revoke this general waiver provision in the 2003 Federal Register notice. And under the Edison Electric case, the fact that they didn't ultimately decide to revoke it doesn't change the fact that they reopened it.
Does seem material to what's properly before us. What are you saying about the Edison Electric case?
Well, in Edison Electric, the court held that reopening occurs where the agency expressly invites comments on and advances an alternative approach to a pre-existing rule. And in that case, the agency invited a comment on a different approach to an existing rule and decided to keep the old one in place. And the court said,
no changes at all?
With no changes at all, or at least nothing material. And the court said that was enough to reopen its underlying legality.
I mean, it's a little, I'm trying to imagine how that plays out here. I haven't got Edison Electric in front of me, I'm sorry to say. But for the agency to say we're thinking of doing something, and then a commenter comes in and says, if you do that, it'll have tremendous consequences that you may not have anticipated. They say, oh, you're right, we're no longer thinking of doing that. That's review, that opens up the underlying rule. It's very peculiar.
Well, here though it's...
They put out an advance notice of proposed rulemaking as a precaution. So as not to get caught in this, they're still reopening it because they're thinking about it.
That's way short of what they did here. They actually proposed to repeal this very waiver on the grounds that it wasn't consistent with the statute. Now their reasons for arguing that it wasn't consistent with the statute weren't identical to our reasons, but that was surely enough to reopen the question. I just had one other point.
Maybe it is under this case. I have got to go back to the case. But if it is, then I guess they'd be better be careful what they think about. Right? Because if you find out what they're thinking about, we can review it.
Well,
don't think about elephants now.
In our view, you don't have to go that far here.
That's a great relief, but can you tell me why?
Just one other point. Kennicott and some of this court's other cases have also stated that where an agency reiterates a rule or a policy in such a way as to render the rule subject to renewed challenge on any substantive ground, then the original rule's basis is also reopened for challenge, and that is certainly true here. There's no question that we're allowed to challenge this new rule's elimination of the requirement. I'm talking now about the offset issue of the elimination of the requirement for an attainment demonstration, and therefore under Kennicott, under that separate category of rulemaking under Kennicott, the agency's basis for the original rule is also reopened. Unless there are further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Link, thank you. Case is submitted.